the mandate of the Seder, Chayiv Adam Liros Hashatzmo Ki'ilu Hu Yotza Mimitzrayim. Every person has to consider themselves as if they personally went out of Mitzrayim. And that is very difficult to imagine with the Seder that you are a slave in Egypt and went out. My wife tells me she at least accomplishes half of it. Every Pesach she feels like she's a slave in Egypt. She never feels she went out. I want to give you, if there's time, three ways of fulfilling that. Three different ways. The whole Seder and the whole Yetzias Mitzrayim revolves around the letter Pei. Pesach is Pesach, a mouth that speaks. Paro, Pei. Pera, bad mouth. Paro. The code word for Yetzias Mitzrayim was Poko Pokadati Eschem, double Pei. Now in the Aleph Beis, there are two Peis. There's the Pei that's in the beginning and the middle of the word, and the Pei at the end of the word. Chazal called the Pei at the beginning and middle the Pesosum, the closed Pei. It's like a spiral. And the Pei that's at the end of the word is open, Pesosuach. And I think that hints to the whole gamut of what's done at the Seder. At the Seder, either you're talking or you're eating. That's it. There's nothing else. Either you have your peh pasuach, your open mouth, talking, or as my mother, Olea Ashron, used to tell me, chew with your mouth closed. When you eat, your mouth is closed. That's the pesasum. That's the closed mouth. So we achieve identifying with Yetzias Mitzrayim in both ways. One verbally, one through the talking, and one through the eating. And I want to explain both of them. How it's possible, both intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, to really feel like you were a slave in Egypt and redeemed. What does that mean? Not necessarily to feel it consciously, but to feel it, we'll see, first intellectually. That's the peh pasuach, the verbal part of the Seder. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. What is the purpose of telling over the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim every year and then remembering it every single day, twice a day? We are not that feeble-minded that if we wouldn't remember Yetzias Mitzrayim every day, twice a day, that we forget it. So it can't be just to remember. There must be something more to it. Basically, our religion is superior in its credibility more than the other major religions, or any religion for that matter, in the fact that the foundation of our religion is something that happened in front of an entire nation. Otherwise, as the Kuzri says, if you're born a Christian, so you are taught the tradition of Christianity by your parents, by your teachers, and you become and believe in Christianity. If you're born a Muslim, you're taught the foundations and the traditions of Islam by your parents and your teachers, and you're a Muslim. If you're born a Jew, so you're taught the traditions and beliefs of Judaism by your parents or your teachers, and you're a Jew. So basically it's an accident of birth. You happen to be born Jewish, so you believe in this. If you've been born something else, you believe something else.
talked with Lewis and said a Jew is never a born an accident of birth. Every generation, every Jew made the choice with great difficulty to stay Jewish.
Okay.
I could not resist.
Okay. Okay. I don't know if that's true, but it sounds nice.
It was very impressive what he said.
So is that all there is? Or if you're interested in thinking, is there something more credible if you would investigate? Would you come to a greater conclusion that Judaism is more credible than other religions? Says the Khuzri, yes. There is something that Judaism has over every other religion. True. At any given time, a person is born and is given over the traditions of his religion. But if you trace those traditions to their source, there's a very big difference between the tradition of Judaism and the tradition of other major religions. How so? A Christian believes what his parents told him, that Yashka claimed to be the Son of God and he came to redeem the world and he died for the sins of mankind and he was resurrected. Those are the foundations of Christianity. And they believe them because their parents told them and their parents told them and their parents told them all the way back, supposedly, to the beginning of all of this. Without going into historical, whatever, just according to what the Christians themselves say, what they believe. Let's see how credible it is at the beginning. You have to go back to the beginning. What was the beginning? The beginning of this tradition was that one man came and claimed to be the Son of God. Now you could believe him, not believe him. Right? There was no DNA test made to make sure that he was the Son of God or not. Right? God didn't sign on the birth certificate. So maybe he was telling the truth, maybe he wasn't telling the truth. His mother, for sure, wanted him to believe he was the Son of God, otherwise there was big problems because he wasn't the son of his father. So, again, you believe him, maybe don't believe him. Maybe he was telling the truth, maybe he wasn't telling the truth. It's the word of one person. What's the other foundation of Christianity? That he was resurrected from the dead. How many people witnessed that? According to the New Testament, 11 of his closest disciples and a group of swooning women, fainting women, swooning women. Now, not to impugn the credibility of women, but swooning women, when you're howishing, you know, you see a lot of things that you don't really see. And his 11 disciples were biased. Because if he didn't come back, they were out of a job. So they had a vested interest in saying he came back. So the foundation, the beginning of that tradition, is on very shaky ground. Because it's either the word of one man, or the word of a small group of people that were biased. How about Islam? That's even worse. The entire foundation of Islam started with a dream that Muhammad had in a cave one night, that the angel Gabriel came to him and revealed to him the Quran and the religion of Islam and told him to go spread it. Nobody witnessed the dream together with Muhammad. He didn't video the dream. Right? It was his own private dream. Maybe he had a stomachache that night and that was where Islam came from. Maybe the angel Gabriel did come to him. It's the word of one man. Muhammad, though, had a very cogent philosophical argument that went along with spreading his religion, which many people found to be extremely intellectually convincing. It went like something like this. Accept my religion or I'll cut off your head. Many people found that to be extremely convincing. The truth is that God wanted these two religions to spread. I'm not going to tell you now why, that's not for now. when we get to the second to the last Iker of Mashiach, we'll speak about why Christianity and Islam were so successful and why God wanted them to be successful. Because they prepare the way for Mashiach. So says the Rambam. Okay, you can think about that for the next few years till we get to the... In any case, so they spread. But if you trace them back to their source, the source is extremely flimsy, shaky, the word of one person or a small group of people.
What about Buddhism?
What about it? It's no different. It's no different. If our religion had started the same way, let's trace our tradition back to the source. If it had been the same, you know, the Jewish people were settled in Tel Aviv, and Moshe and Aaron and Miriam came to them one day and said, "You got to hear what happened to us. We were taking a trek around the world. We got caught in Egypt. They made us slaves. And then God brought 10 plagues and got us out of there. And we crossed the Red Sea. And he gave us this Torah. And here it is." And they tried to convince the Jewish people that they saw these things. And they heard these things. And they experienced these things. Then our religion would be the same as theirs. Same basis. But that's not what happened. Moshe didn't come and say, "I saw these things." He said, "You saw them." The entire nation was in Egypt. They all were slaves. They all saw the 10 plagues. They all saw and experienced the splitting of the Red Sea. They all heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu speak in Har Sinai. It's something that supposedly happened in front of an entire nation. Now, how did I get that tradition? How did I get, because my parents told me, how did they know? Because their parents told them. All the way back, supposedly, to the people who experienced it. Now, either it happened, but if it didn't happen, how in the world and when was it made up? So there's only 4 possibilities. And all the other 4 possibilities, aside from the fact that it really happened, are very improbable. And therefore, because it's something, again, I could make up something and try to convince you that I'm somebody I'm not, or I saw something I didn't, but something that supposedly happened in front of an entire nation is almost impossible to falsify and to make up. We'll see in 1 second why. I'm going to discuss it in detail. 1 possibility is that I received this tradition from my parents, my teachers, them from their parents and their teachers, because it really happened way back then. And the people who saw it and witnessed it passed it over, no pun intended, to future generations. There's another possibility. It never happened. Never happened. But Moshe Rabbeinu was a very charismatic person. And he convinced the Jewish people that they saw all these things when they didn't see anything. There was never 10 plagues. There was never the splitting of the Red Sea. There was never the giving of the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu convinced them that they saw and experienced all these things. He was tremendously charismatic. He was a wizard, whatever he had. He had a long extension cord and a microphone, and was able to get an entire nation to believe that they saw and experienced things that they never saw and experienced. Very improbable. If I would have come here today, very shaken up, white as a ghost, and said, "Look, I know you're not going to believe me. I know this sounds fantastic. I have no reason to lie to you. I've sobered up since Purim already 2 weeks. But I promise you, what happened to me on the way here was, I was parked by a red light, stopped by a red light, there was no one else around, and as I was sitting there, a flying saucer landed on the hood of my car. And 10 little green men got out and danced around the car, got back into the flying saucer and took off. And I'm telling you, it happened." Now, many of you, I assume, I hope, would say, "Look, he's never said something like this before. He's not crazy. Right? He has no reason to lie to us. So maybe it's not going to happen. At least there'd be a doubt in your minds. Maybe. Maybe. I hope so. Some of you. But if I would have come here today and said, listen, do you remember last week when we were sitting here that a flying saucer came through that door, landed on this table, 10 little green men got out, danced around us, got back in, and it flew out the window? Don't you remember that?
No.
I don't think anybody here. If there's somebody here, I'd like to see you after I have a bridge of them. I don't think anybody here would have a doubt that I was lying. Because I may be able to convince you that I saw something I didn't see. But it's almost impossible to convince you that you saw something you didn't see. And it's not just we're talking about convincing a few people, a sheer. We're talking about convincing an entire nation. And we're not only talking about regular people, we're talking about Jews.
Right.
It's hard enough to convince Jews they saw what they did see, let alone what they didn't see. Shamsu for her says that one of the proofs that the Torah is true is that we accepted it. Because we are a very stubborn people. And if we had any doubts, we never would have accepted it. So it's very improbable that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to convince an entire people that they experienced and saw what they didn't experience and see, and then that they were convinced and they passed this on. So that's not a probable possibility. Third possibility. First possibility is that it really happened. Second possibility, Moshe Rabbeinu convinced them. Third possibility. Nobody convinced them. They made it up. They all got together. They made a hoax. They decided, let's start a religion. So we're going to make up these supernatural stories about 10 plagues and splittings of Red Seas and God giving us the Torah. We made up the whole thing and we'll pass that down to our children. Now, if it was just a nice story of a glorious beginning of a nation, maybe. Maybe. But this story had tacked onto it a Torah that was not easy to keep. You all know that. Not easy at all. Many laws that were totally against the grain of morality at the time. Egypt. Incest was a common practice in Egypt. The Torah prohibited it. The Torah prohibited eating a lot of things that were considered delicacies. The Torah demanded taras hamishpacha, not eating on Yom Kippur, chametz on Pesach, cleaning your house for Pesach. Why in the world would anyone make that up and foist it on your children if you know it's not true? If I did not believe that God said I should get up every morning at 5 o'clock and put little black boxes on my head and my arm, there is no way in the world that I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and put little black boxes on my head and my arm. If I thought for a minute that somebody made this up 3,000 years ago, there's no way in the world I'd be so stupid to do it. I can't imagine why people who don't believe the Torah is divine do these things. For what purpose? If I believe that God said to do it, then there's a reason to do it. But why would people knowingly foist such a hoax on their children, knowingly that all of this is meaningless because they made it up, and have their children basically lead lives keeping all these laws for no purpose because they made it up? And even if, let's say, a whole nation could get together and make such a hoax, some people are going to feel guilty at some point, right before they die, they're going to call their children in and say, listen, forget about the black boxes, we made it up. Right? There's no purpose to it. It's all a hoax. We just made it up, we wanted to make you feel good, but I can't go through with this because I see what kind of terrible interference it is in your life and I know it doesn't mean anything. How many people would have on their deathbed admitted that it was a hoax? Didn't happen. So that's improbable. Next possibility. Fourth possibility. It never happened. Nobody ever made it up at the time. Nobody ever convinced them. It was made up 1,000 years ago by Ezra. 1,000 years later. 1,000 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Jewish people were in exile. They were at their low ebb of self-esteem. They needed something to boost their morale. So one rainy day, Ezra had nothing to do. He made up the whole Torah. And he gave them a glorious past that they never heard of, because it never happened. If it never happened, they could never have heard about it. And he all of a sudden discovered this Torah, and he revealed to them, this is a Torah that your ancestors got 1,000 years ago. They never heard of it. Now, imagine Ezra coming to a people. They never heard of anything like this. For 1,000 years, nobody ever heard of it. And all of a sudden, Ezra discovers this glorious story of their ancestors tacked on with a lot of laws that means they have to get divorced from their non-Jewish spouses. And nobody says a word. Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Right? Oh, sure. Why shouldn't we accept it? Because if it really happened, how come nobody heard of it before? How come you're the first and only person who ever heard of this? Because if it never happened, nobody could have heard of it. So isn't somebody going to question Ezra, why should we accept this? When if it really happened 1,000 years ago, why hasn't anybody ever heard of it? If I came here today and told you, you may have learned American history in school, but I know something you don't know. You see, right after Abraham Lincoln, the next president was not Johnson. Yeah, Andrew Johnson was the next president. He wasn't the next president. Sam Cohen was the next president. I know about it. I discovered it. Don't you think somebody's going to say, that's very nice, but how come nobody else ever heard of him? How come he's not mentioned anywhere? And if it never happened, it couldn't have been mentioned. And nobody could have known about it. And oh, you want us to keep all these laws and nobody ever heard of this, and you tell us that this happened 1,000 years ago? Some Jew is going to raise his hand and say, I don't buy into this. And a lot of Jews are going to buy into it. So it's very difficult. No questions today. Just questions today for the sake. If you have questions, I'm never going to finish. And there's too much that I want to give over to you. So it's very improbable that it could have been made up 1,000 years later if it never happened. Last possibility. The only other way that we could have such a tradition, and it never happened. Nobody was ever convinced that it happened at the time. Nobody ever made it up at the time. Nobody made it up 1,000 years afterwards. It happened, but it didn't happen the way the Torah said. It was some very uneventful thing. There were a few Jews in Egypt who worked overtime. They made a sit-in, had a few strikes. They left Egypt. It was the rainy season, so they jumped over a puddle, and they got a few laws. And over 1,000 years, it got a little exaggerated. And from one generation to the other, as people told it over, they embellished it. And the next generation, the puddle became a little stream. And the next generation, they didn't jump over the stream, but they made rafts and they went over. The next generation, the rafts didn't sound so good. They went scuba diving underneath the stream. Next generation is ready to see. And the next generation, the sea split. And little by little, the sardine that was caught became a whale. And we received that tradition after its embellishments over thousands of years with all the changes. And that sounds reasonable, that it did change. Because when you have 10 people in a room and you play telephone, the message changes. You tell the first person in line something, you tell them to pass it on, by the time it gets to the 10th person, it's completely different. So wouldn't it be reasonable to say that if there was a tradition of what people saw and experienced when they left Egypt, that till we got it, it's changed, till it was written down maybe 1,000 years after that, if you don't believe that the Torah was dictated to Moshe Rabbeinu and written at the time, right, if you believe like Apikorsim, so it's reasonable that if it wasn't written down and it had to be passed on verbally from mouth to mouth, that it got changed. Why not? The answer is the following. We're not talking about one line of telephone. Imagine the following. You have 100 people in a room playing telephone. 10 lines of 10 people each. Okay. The first people in line are taken into another room and they see something. They witness something. We don't know what. They were in a closed room. Nobody was there except those 10 people. But we know for sure, whatever they saw the same thing. They were all in that same room and saw the same thing. We don't know what they saw. We tell them now, pass it on to the person next to you in line. Tell them what you saw. And then they pass it on. Now we go to the 10th people in line. 10 lines, 10 people, 10, number 10 in each line. And we say, what did you hear? And each one reports to us the exact same thing as the other. Now we don't know if that's the exact same thing that the first people said. It may have changed. But we do know that all 10 people in the back say the same thing. Now there's two possibilities. One is that it didn't change. Whatever the first 10 people saw together, they passed on and it wasn't changed, and the 10 people in the end say the same thing. And that's exactly the same thing that started. Or no, it changed. But it changed 10 times independently the same way. That's what has to happen. It changed in each line. It's not the same thing that started, but it changed 10 times the same exact way, independently. That's much more unreasonable, improbable, than it didn't change at all. The only problem is, why didn't it change? Isn't it reasonable to say that if something is passed on from generation to generation, it's going to get changed? The answer is not necessarily. I'll give you another example. Imagine 100 people walking single file through the deepest African forest? Jungle. And all of a sudden, at the same moment, all of them sink into the mud, to their waist. So now I have 100 people in line, in mud, to their waist. They can't move. They can only talk to the people behind them and in front of them. The first two people are right next to each other. And number one, all of a sudden, starts to have some kind of seizure, some kind of fit. And number two has no idea what to do for him. But he knows that his life's in danger if he doesn't do something. He can reach out, do something, but he doesn't know what to do. He knows that number 100 is a doctor. So he yells to number three, I'm going to describe to you exactly what the symptoms of number one are. Pass them on to number four, number five, all the way to number 100, he's a doctor. When the doctor hears what the symptoms are, let him pass back to me what I should do. That's what happens. Do you think that it's going to change on either side? No. I'll tell you what. Because it's not a game. People know that somebody's life depends on this. They're going to be very careful to report exactly what they heard from number two and what they hear from the doctor back to number two. Chances are it's not going to change. And if it changes, it's going to change in details that make no difference. But the things that make a difference to that person's life, if it really happened, and our ancestors witnessed all these things, and they knew that God told them to keep this Torah, and the Torah their life depended on, not just their life in this world, but their life and the life of all future generations of this world and the next, then they're going to be very careful to pass it over in a very, very
accurate
way, and to be faithful to make sure there's not change. And yet there are differences in details, but no one ever had a different Mesorah. Even the ones who don't believe in our Mesorah, the Tzedukim, the Karoyim, conservative, reform. They don't claim they have an alternate Mesorah. There never was an alternate Mesorah. If it changed, it should have changed 20 different ways. We should have a Mesorah, we should have a tradition of a sea splitting, we should have a tradition of rafts going over, of submarines, of puddles. There should be a 10, 15, 20 different versions. There isn't, there's only one version. And not only do we believe in that, the Christians also believe in all of this. And so do the Muslims. They just add, subtract, or distort. But the basis, they also believe in. So these three major religions all believe in this. I once had a woman come to me. She wanted to convert. She said, I'd like to convert to Judaism. So I said to her, well, what religion are you now? And why do you want to leave your religion? Why do you want to convert to Judaism? She said, I'm Catholic. So I said, well, what's wrong with Catholicism? Yeah. She said, well, there's some things that Catholicism teaches that I just can't swallow. I just can't accept it. So I thought she was talking about a man being God or a virgin birth or one of these other things. So I said to her, could you give me an example of one of the things that Catholicism teaches that you can't accept? She said, yes, the splitting of the Red Sea. I said, I hate to tell you this, but it's not the Catholics who went through the Red Sea, it's we Jews. She said, you guys believe in that too? I said, yeah, we believe in that. And I'll tell you something else. The Muslims also believe, forget about Islam. That was the end of that conversion. I don't know what happened to her in the end, but she was really flabbergasted. In any case, so of all the possibilities, four of them are improbable. The only one that's left is that it really happened. So the fact that the foundation of our emunah, our occurrences that happened in front of an entire nation, which very improbable to have ever been made up at any point, or even to have changed. So the most probable is that it happened exactly the way that we received. And not only that, but the fact that we have an unbroken chain of tradition. How do I know all these things happen? Because my parents or their surrogates, my teachers told me. And then how do they know? Their parents or their teachers told them, all the way back to the people who actually experienced it. Those two things make it extremely credible. And therefore, once a year, we speak about this in great detail to identify and to trace back with that unbroken chain of tradition back to Yetzias Mitzrayim that strengthens our emunah. That's the intellectual part. By speaking about it, thinking about it, understanding what I just said, it makes you feel like you were there. Because intellectually, it is so credible. And the other alternatives are so improbable that it probably happened. So I can feel like intellectually I was there. That I also witnessed these things. That's one idea. It doesn't mean you have to feel like you were building pyramids for Paro. Or you were a slave. It means you have to feel intellectually that the same things that our ancestors experienced are so real to me, it's as if I experienced them too. That's one dimension, one aspect. Second aspect. And that's the eating aspect. The Shurei Das, the Telzer HaShiva, Rabbi Yosef Yehuda Leib Blum, asked the following question. He asked it in a very refined way. I'm going to ask it in a not so refined way to make it much more potent. He says, you know, if the purpose, he asks it about all mitzvahs, but he specifically mentions the Seder. He says, if the purpose of the Seder is to make me feel like I went through Egyptian slavery and came out, it's not geared for that. You know what would be geared for that? We'd all get together in the Orange Bowl. I come from Miami, so that's the Orange Bowl, whatever you want. And we'd see a play. Just like the Goyim do on Easter. Sunrise, they go into the Orange Bowl, and they have a passion play. And they see this one is Yashkin, this one is Pontius Pilate, and this one, and they see this play, and it makes an impression. And they leave really feeling like they experienced this. Now, if that could work for something that never happened, surely it could work for something that did happen. So, but I have a better idea even. Yeah. Right. My idea is even better than this, but according to him, he was Nifter in the 1930s. Today, we could have a video, and we could hire Steve Spielberg to make special effects. And we could have Mamish Esser Makos and Kriyas Yamsuf look even better than the real. Now, when I was 8 years old, I was in a Hebrew school. And maybe I was 10 years old, maybe 10. It was a Hebrew school in Miami. And the Hebrew, at that time, the Ten Commandments by Cecil B. DeMille came out. That was the premiere. And before it came out into the regular movie theaters, they had a special thing for Hebrew schools to go and see this. So the Hebrew school that I was attending took us to see the Ten Commandments. I was all of 10 years old. And it really made an impression on me. I mean, if you've ever seen the movie, right? I admit I saw it. If you want to listen to me and then say that, well, I heard Rabbi Lev say it, so I know what it's all about. I remember they had, you know, this trick photography of the splitting of the Red Sea. I remember leaving that movie theater and saying to myself, if Cecil B. DeMille could split the Red Sea, then God could too. And that really strengthened my emunah. From that point on, I had no doubts. Now, it wasn't exactly like the book, but it was pretty close. But remember, it made a tremendous impression. So if we made a video, right, and made it really look like you could really, you know, three dimension with the glasses, and you really feel like you're there, and you could smell it and feel it, and with all of the special effects, I guarantee that if you were in a seder like that, says the Shurei Das, you would feel more like you were a slave in Egypt and went out than the seder that God designed. I want to feel 210 years of Egyptian slavery. So what do? Eat some bitter herbs. Even if you're eating horseradish, it's not exactly capturing 210 years of slavery. Surely if you're eating lettuce, you may feel like a rabbit, but you surely don't feel like a slave. So what did God have in mind when he designed his kind of Seder and not the Shurei Das? I have a better one. If they asked me to design a Seder, this would be my Seder. Everybody has to invite 20 people to the Seder. When they get there, you divide them into two groups, Group A and Group B. Group A, you give whips and clubs, and Group B, you give cement and mortar. You take them into your backyard, and you have Group A beat the daylights out of Group B while they did pyramids in your backyard. That goes on for a quarter of the night. After a quarter of the night, you blow your whistle. See, if you make the Seder, you get to be the coordinator. You don't have to do any work or get beaten or anything. You just get to blow the whistle. So, at the quarter of the night, you blow the whistle, and you tell the people, switch. Now, Group B beat Group A as they build pyramids. At midnight, you blow your whistle again, and you say, everybody's free. No more working, no more beating. Please, come inside, we'll have a nice meal, and everybody's free. I guarantee you, the people at my Seder will feel more like they were slaves in Egypt and went free than God's Seder. Right? Now we're going to eat lettuce so we can feel 210 years of Egyptian slavery. It seems very difficult to understand. Now, I agree, the people in my Seder may never come back to my Seder. But for 1 year, they really feel it. So why didn't God design that Seder? So I'll tell you what the Shurei Das says, and I'm going to combine it with something the Michta Meliol says, and the two together will make you feel much better at the end of your Seder this year, instead of feeling a little depressed and disappointed that another year went by and you didn't feel like you were a slave in Egypt. The Shurei Das says, I'll give you an example to it, which I always like to give. There is a concept called subliminal advertising. This was a big rage in the 1960s, 50s, end of the 50s, when they had drive-in movies. A drive-in movie, you could a whole car go in for one admission. So they didn't make their money on the admission. What did they make their money on? The popcorn and soda at intermission. And they wanted you to eat a lot of popcorn and drink a lot of soda. So what they found is that if they advertise openly, it's not so convincing. But if they put in the movie a few frames that pass by so quickly that you don't see them consciously. But they go into your subconscious, and they're like a hypnotic suggestion. The people found that in the intermission, they had this compulsion to eat popcorn and drink soda. Because it was flashed on the screen so quickly, it went in with the movie. It's against the law to advertise like that. They say that audio-wise also, that there were songs in the 60s that had subliminal to the soundtrack, just barely audible, but it went into your subconscious about taking drugs or whatever. And this could be started the whole drug culture, drug generation. Whether it's true or not is irrelevant. But the concept is the same idea that the Shri Das says. He says something that affects you externally. You get beaten at the Seder. You see a play. It's all external. It makes an impression. It wears off very quickly. But something that bypasses the external and goes directly into your neshama lasts a lot longer. Now let me add the Michta Meliyahu to it, and together it's really effective. The Michta Meliyahu says that time is not a straight line. We haven't, time didn't start when God created it at the beginning of creation, and from then on we're just going constantly ahead in time. Time is like a spiral. The way I like to understand it is the following. Imagine 365 elevator shafts. You know those elevator shafts that are glass or plastic that you can see the elevator going up and down? Round, these brown shafts, 365 in a circle. Each shaft has an opening, one to the other, and then the other one to the next one all around, and up. So the elevator goes horizontally and then vertically. Each shaft represents a time zone, another day of the year. The elevator started on Aleph Tishrei, that elevator shaft called Aleph Tishrei, on the ground floor. That's when man was created. At that point, the memory, all of the ideas of that creation saturated that entire elevator shaft. It was filled with the memory of the creation of man. We're now on floor 5,767. But when we come around to the first day of Tishrei, we go through that elevator shaft. The elevator went around on the ground floor till Chof Tes Elul, and then went up a floor and started again, Aleph Tishrei. The same shafts, the same time zones. Every year we return to the time zone, the elevator shaft, called Aleph Tishrei, and in that elevator shaft is the memory of the creation of man. So if you can connect into it, that memory goes into your neshama. Every time we come around to the elevator shaft, called the 15th day of Nisan, the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which was on floor 2,448 of that shaft, permeates that shaft. It's saturated with the memory of the Exodus from Egypt. It's still there. And when we come around again into that shaft, it surrounds us. But you have to connect into it. Now, how do you connect into that memory? So imagine two computers. One has in its memory a database about lions, pictures and information, everything you want to know about lions is in the database, in the memory of this computer. You want to transfer that file into your computer so you'll have that memory too. It'll be in the memory of your computer now. How do you do that? You don't tie a string between the monitors and have the picture go over the string, the lion walk over the string into your computer. It doesn't work like that. That's all external. You have to have a cable that will go into the guts of your one computer and into the guts of your computer and transfer the electronic information from one to the other. And you need the right kind of command to do it. The cable doesn't have to look like a line, but the cable has to be exactly configured, the right amount of pins, and the right configuration, the right size. if the pins are too long, too short, not the right number, or not the right configuration, it won't work. That's exactly what happens on Pesach. We pass through this time zone called the 15th day of Nisan. We're in that elevator shaft, high above, where Yetzias Mitzrayim took place, but the same shaft. So the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim is contained in that shaft. We pass through it. If we can connect our neshamas into that memory, the collective memory of the Jewish people, then the memory will go into our neshama. But you need a cable. The cable has to go directly into your neshama and has to go into the neshama of the time. It can't do into the externals. So true, a play, beating, will all be external, but that's like tying the two monitors together. It's not going to work. So what will work? The cable. But the cable, only God knows how to make that cable that will attach your neshama to the time zone. And God said the cable is matzah, maror, korban pesach. And it's not just any matzah, and any maror, and any korban pesach, and not just any amount, and not just eating it in any amount of time, and not in any position. It has to be exact. The exact amount of pins, the exact size, the exact configuration, the exact kind of matzah, and the exact amount of time, and just as foolish as it would be to say, a cable's a cable. Why do you have to count the pins, and who cares what configuration they are, what they look like, or how long, or how short? Just get the cable, and it'll work. It won't work. It won't work unless it's exact. So too, the people at the Seder who are measuring out the matzah, right, using their cards or these things or whatever, and have to eat it within 2 minutes, 9 minutes or whatever. And there's always people who are making fun. Ah, what difference does it make? Matzah's matzah, 2 minutes, 9 minutes. What are you measuring? But those same people would say the same thing about a cable. What do you make difference? How big the pins are, how many there are, what configuration? Yeah, it makes a difference. If they're not exact, it won't work. If they're exact, then that's the cable that will connect you to the memory banks. And then your neshama is charged, like charging a battery. When you charge your car battery, right, you can't see externally that anything's changed. If the car battery starts to glow and starts to get bigger, run. That's not supposed to happen. It looks the same as it did before you charged it. How do you know it's charged? You can start the car. Your neshama becomes charged. You don't have to feel it. It may make no difference to you externally. Maybe yes, if you're on a higher madrega. But it doesn't have to. Once your neshama is charged up, everything you do the next year, all the mitzvahs come from a charged neshama where the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim is part of your neshama. We did the external by speaking about it. That was external. Now we do the internal by eating. That is a charged neshama. And you don't have to see it. If you transfer the memory from one computer to the other and you don't have a monitor, you'll never see that it's there. But it's there. It doesn't make a difference if you can see it or not. So when we say that a person has to consider atzmo, his essence, as if he went out of Mitzrayim, it's not necessarily the externals. It's not that you have to feel it externally. But if you did the mitzvahs properly, and at the end of the Seder, you can say, Chasal Sidur Pesach Kehil Chosa, I did it right. Then you created that cable that enabled the memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim to transfer to your neshama and charge it up for another year until it wears down, and the next year you need to charge it again. So that is the two ways that it works. It works through the intellectual, external, verbal speaking, and thinking about the ideas that I told you, why this story is credible, because supposedly it happened in front of an entire nation, and the other possibilities are improbable, that it didn't happen, and it's not was made up at some time. And then the actual eating that you're supposed to eat is God's way of charging on the Shabbos with the actual memory of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is the collective memory of the Jewish people, which hovers in that time zone called the 15th day of Nisan, and the cable to be able to make that transfer are these subtle mitzvahs. Okay, Chakashu v'sameach.